This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 21st of June. How has the most pro-Brexit constituency in the UK responded to what's being said by the political parties about immigration? Two prominent business voices discuss the politicians' offers. Does growth in the short term depend on migration? After Northamptonshire's chief constable is sacked for lying about his past, a former inspector of Constabulary tells us the quality of chief police officers is not as good as it should be. French football captain Kylian Mbappe sports a mask over his broken nose at the Euros. A maker of bespoke masks for injured sports people helps me to try one on. And two refugee artists share their experience of being smuggled into the country in the back of a lorry. Throughout the election campaign, we've been focusing on some of the key issues in battleground seats. When Reform UK's leader Nigel Farage unveiled his party's contract with voters this week, he said this should be the immigration election. That and asylum are near the top of voters' priorities, at least according to the polls, but behind the issue of the cost of living. In a few minutes, we'll get the business perspective on migration. But before that, The World Tonight's Jamie Kumarasamy has been to see how the issue is playing out among voters in Boston in Lincolnshire. The market town experienced a big influx of workers after 10 countries from Eastern Europe joined the EU in 1998. In the referendum on Brexit in 2016, Boston saw the highest Leave vote in the UK. Richard Tice from Reform UK hopes that will help him overturn a Conservative majority there of 25,500.
It is market day here in Boston, and this is a place which has had a market at least since 1132. There are stalls selling everything from flowers to clothes. There's a big vape stall in front of me. And as you can probably hear, there's a soundtrack as well. Sonny Rollins being played on the saxophone by a busker of a certain age over here. Let's go over and see whether he thinks immigration is an important issue in this election.
I think it is, yeah. We're getting overcrowded. We've got to stop it somehow.
What are the problems? Why do you think it's such an important issue?
Well, basically, the overcrowding of the country, the strain on the national health, the strain on the education, strain on everything. I sort of came up voting Conservative and leaning towards the Conservatives. You know, I'm thinking about changing, but...
Changing to which party?
Well, another party. I suppose Labour.
What about Reform UK? Because Nigel Farage has taken over as leader.
Yeah.
Previously, the chairman is actually running here as the candidate for Reform UK, Richard Tice. They say they want to stop all non-essential immigration immediately.
I don't know if you should go that far. No.
Well, let's see what the stallholders here have to say. Now, there's one over here selling everything from puzzles to garden gnomes.
Yeah, you want to go and do it?
Yeah. Can I go over here?
So, has the lady behind the stall, Caroline, been following the general election campaign?
I am following it, yeah. I quite like Nigel Farage. I mean, he's got a lot going. He did have years ago and no one took him on, but they should listen to him now.
What is it about him?
It's immigration, a lot. I think there's too many illegal immigrants in this country. I haven't got a problem with anybody who wants to come over here and work and pay their dues. But if they're coming over here just to live off the state and send money back to their families, then no, I don't agree with that.
2 and 6, 26, 5 and 9, 59.
The national numbers have been looking better for Nigel Farage and his Reform UK. And at the afternoon bingo at Boston's Glidodrome, the people we spoke to in the largely older white crowd all said they were worried about immigration. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Reform will have the kind of success that long-time bingo regular John did.
I'm the biggest jackpot winner they've ever had here in Boston.
How much?
Not far short of 200,000.
So, is immigration an important issue for him?
You go to the hospital now, you go in there and it's absolute chock-a-block. And a lot of it, the people that are in there... They're immigrants and people that have come across.
Are you going to vote in this election? Do you know where you're going to be putting your cross yet?
It's looking a bit like Labour at the minute. I don't think it'll be the man that's in now.
I'm going to mention another name that's in this election now, Nigel Farage.
No, I think he's a yes man. You could say he's another Trump. No, I've no time for him.
What about Brexit? Did you vote for Brexit?
I voted for us to stay in. We should never have got out in the first place.
Here we are. Here's the famous Westgate. The one that's always on the news when they're talking about Brexit and everything.
Standing near the most visible stretch of businesses run by new arrivals from Eastern Europe, local historian and tour guide Jane Kitely, an expert on Boston's centuries-old European trading links, tells us about its more recent ones.
The first immigrants we had were the Portuguese, and they tended to go back. And then we got the Poles and Lithuanians and Latvians. Now it's mainly Romanians and Bulgarians.
And how has that changed the character of the town?
Well, I think a lot of people just feel intimidated and overrun, really. Not by specific people, but because there's so many of them. I've got nothing against them whatsoever, but I think this area can be quite narrow-minded.
Moje po
polsku. Ja też. Mieszkałem w Polsce.
O, mieszkałem.
Some come for temporary work in factories and farms. Others, like Jurate, put down roots. She has lived in Boston for 14 years and is now the leader of the town's 4,000-strong Lithuanian community. So, does she understand why local people say immigration is too high?
I try to imagine that it's Lithuania, right? And if it was something like similar thing, right? People, different communities came to my city or town. Maybe I wouldn't be so much pleased because of the changes. But is it any other way to solve this problem? You know, not bringing migrant, for example, to Lincolnshire. These people, migrant communities, are needed to work in the factories, in the fields. And even those communities who come here, they try to assimilate.
At Boston's Centenary Methodist Church, an evening concert, and that most patriotic of hymns, I Vow to Thee My Country, played by the Salvation Army Band. They are hosting election hustings here on Monday, but church leader, the Reverend Dr. Val Ogden, thinks that whatever happens in the election, immigration will become less of an issue here over time.
We know that their attentions, but in terms of building community, I'm constantly in awe of all the work that the schools do, for example, in raising up a generation which perhaps, hopefully, does not carry some of the prejudice that an older generation might.
That report from Jamie Kumarasamy in Boston in Lincolnshire, ending with the resounding sounds of I Vow to Thee My Country. There's a full list of candidates standing in the Boston and Skegness constituency on the BBC website. Let's explore the issue of immigration a bit further with two people from the business community. Paul Drexler is the former president of the Confederation of British Industry, the CBI. At the CBI's conference last year, he suggested Labour was winning over business. And Wilfred Emmanuel Jones is an entrepreneur, the creator of the Black Farmer range of food products. He was a parliamentary candidate in Wiltshire for the Conservatives in 2010 and remains a backer of the party. Paul, Wilfred, thank you both for being with us on The World Tonight. Let's start briefly, if we can, with the bigger picture. Paul Drexler, more people are arriving than leaving. 685,000 in 2023 was the net migration figure, well above double, in fact, what it was in 2010. So what do you think has driven that?
Well, look, good evening, and thank you very much for inviting me on. Look, I think this is an incredibly important conversation that we're not having properly in the country. Everybody, nearly all the people who came here that you mentioned, came here as a result of government policy, as a result of decisions by government. And if we look at the top three categories, first of those was students. A few years ago, we set ourselves a target to recruit about 600,000 international students annually. That has now become a vital ingredient in terms of universities and the financial viability. The second decision that was made, and quite rightly, was to open up our doors to refugees from Hong Kong, Ukraine and Afghanistan. That was, again, government policy. And the third area was about supporting the economy, particularly in areas such as hospitality, vital talent, and lastly, and very importantly, health and care.
Well, for Emmanuel, the big rise comes after, effectively, in the years after the COVID pandemic. What do you think explains that?
I mean, the thing that we all have to understand is this, that people come to this country in order to improve their lives and the lives of their children. And what we mustn't forget, it takes a very entrepreneurial spirit to leave everything that you're familiar with to come to a foreign country in order to improve your lot. And you only come to this country if you do not have the opportunities in your country of birth.
But do you think something has changed in terms of the work ethic here post-COVID? Well,
yeah, one of the big things I think we have to take into consideration is this, is that the Eastern Europeans were welcomed in a lot of places because actually they had a much better work ethic than people in this country. It is one of the greatest challenges that we have in this country is that foreigners, be they Eastern Europeans or be they Indians, have a much stronger work ethic.
And is that what incentivizes you to employ them in your business?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think the thing is this, is that the thing about Asians and people from Eastern European is they don't feel owed. They feel as though they have to work hard in order to prove their lot. What happens with the British culture at the moment, the British work culture, is there's a feeling of entitlement.
Right.
And therefore,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just conscious of time. Let's look at some of the policy proposals. To cap or not to cap numbers. Conservative policy, Paul Drexler, there is a cap based on recommendations from the Migration Advisory Committee. Labour says it won't set a target, but it is considering restoring the resident labour market test, abolished under Boris Johnson, because the Migration Advisory Committee said it costs more to administer than its economic benefit. In other words, the requirement that jobs have to be advertised in this country before employers look elsewhere. What do you make of those?
Well, look, I think the first thing to say is we've had 10 years of targets and caps that have demonstrated to the public there's no reason to believe or trust them. And the reason a cap makes no sense is that the number of immigrants that we have in this country is decided by the policies that we have for international students, vital work and talent, and refugees.
Okay.
That's what sets the number. I think inevitably that number will come down. I think a new government will think of practical ways to make that happen.
The caps will not work. If you're an employer and you're looking to employ people, you desperately want people who are prepared to work hard. I run a company and it is, you know, I've always got jobs available, but what I'm finding is that the people from this country do not want those jobs. And so if you want to run a business, the only way you can run a business in this day and age is to be able to have people who want to work, and they tend to be people from Eastern Europe and from Asia.
Let me ask you both then about what you could call the centrepiece of Labour's policy more broadly and its kind of appeal to the voters, and that is growth. Does it need to be more candid about the role of immigration in growth, at least in the short term? Paul Drexler?
I think that's a super and important question. I think they're 100% right to prioritise growth through business investment, support from the private sector, because that is the only way to pay the taxes that we need to raise to fund our public services. So absolutely clear. I think the second thing is, depending on where those areas of growth are, we may or may not have the skills we need in this country at this time. And if they're not readily available and we want to grow quickly, then we will need to open the door to talent to come in from outside.
Wilfred Emmanuel James.
Okay. What I was going to say is this. What we mean by growth is that you create an environment that is going to encourage entrepreneurialism. Unless you create that environment, we're always going to struggle with growth. I'm a Thatcherite, and one of the things that Thatcher did is that she created an environment that anyone from any walk of life felt they're able to go and start up their own businesses. That is the key. So when we talk about growth, sometimes it's so grand that we don't realize it's encouraging small individuals to give it a go.
And as politicians are concerned, it's an aspiration that they can't deliver unless they create the environment. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. So rather than promising people, says we will create the environment so you could go out and be entrepreneurial. That is a big message I would like to see going across.
Wilfred, can businesses be incentivized to skill and recruit domestically? I mean, Labour suggested skill improvement plans focused on the sectors that are most dependent at the moment on migrant labour. The Conservatives introduced some changes, raising the threshold for people who come in on skilled worker visas. What approach do you think works?
What, I mean, business has a lot to sort of deal with. I mean, it costs money to train people. You are prepared to train people if people have the right sort of mindset. And I think that we have to go back to when people are at school, when they're at universities. We tend to live in a society where people think if they go and get a qualification, that should means they're entitled to a job with a big salary. And that fundamentally has to change. I think what we need to be doing is encouraging people, not necessarily to be going to universities, for them to feel that they could still go and actually create a business and be successful without going through this educational. I think that's caused some of the greatest problems that we have in our society. That's one of the reasons why people don't want to work, because they feel so entitled because they've had an education.
Paul Drexler, a last point. Do you think that we have to accept significant levels of migration if we want the benefits of economic growth?
Well, I think there's two things. We have to make this country an exciting and attractive place for people to work, people within this country, and people to come from overseas. And at the end of the day, we have to be able to provide the people that we need in all the different jobs to meet the needs in the public, whether that be doctors or nurses, or people in care homes, or people in hotels. We need this to be the best country in the world in which to work, to live, to play, and to invest.
Paul Drexler, former president of the Confederation of British Industry, and Wilfred Emmanuel Jones, the entrepreneur and creator of the Black Farmer range of food products. Thank you both very much. Pleasure to talk to you both. And I hope that gave some enlightenment for people listening at home. Now, Nigel Farage has told the BBC that NATO and the European Union provoked the war in Ukraine. In the latest of Nick Robinson's party leader interviews during the election campaign, Mr. Farage, who leads Reform UK, said he predicted war 8 years before Russia invaded after it annexed Crimea from Ukraine.
It was obvious to me that the ever eastward expansion of NATO and the European Union was giving this man a reason to his Russian people to say they're coming for us again and to go to war. We've provoked this war. Of course it's his fault. He's used what we've done as an excuse.
But we provoked the invasion of Ukraine.
Yes, and very interestingly, once again, 10 years ago when I predicted this, by the way, I'm the only person in British politics that predicted what would happen. And of course, everyone said I was a pariah for daring to suggest it. George Robertson, former Labour cabinet minister, who went on to become the Secretary General of NATO, has in the last couple of weeks said the war is a direct result of EU expansion.
The interview with Nick Robinson is available now on the BBC iPlayer. I don't need to introduce my next guest because Nigel Farage has just done it for me. Lib Robertson, good evening to you. Thanks for being with us on The World Tonight.
Good evening. Yeah.
Two points. Let's deal with one very quickly. He suggested that you have been critical, somewhat critical at least, of the way the European Union has handled countries like Ukraine in remarks you've made before the election campaign began.
Well, that's absurd. I haven't said anything in the last couple of weeks at all about Ukraine.
Prior to the election beginning.
Yeah, but I've never said anything like that. And he is making a direct statement that I said that it was the direct result of the EU. I have never said
that. What did you say, just to clear that up, about the role of the EU association agreement in provoking the Ukrainians to reject it?
The people of Ukraine want to join NATO. So it's not that what we want for Ukraine, it's what the Ukrainians want for themselves. Yeah. And of course, Vladimir Putin fears democracy next door. He fears a country that believes in free speech and a free press and in the rule of law.
So does he then have a point when...
He doesn't have a point. He's parroting the Kremlin line. He's making excuses for Vladimir Putin.
But in creating part of the environment in which President Putin made the decision, and Nigel Farage says it's his decision and he has to be blamed for it, of invading, Was the expansion of the EU part of the poisoning, if you like, of the atmosphere and the relationship between the West and Russia?
No, I don't think so at all. Well, the EU is not expanding. NATO is not expanding. Countries make individual decisions themselves. And I stood beside Vladimir Putin on the 28th of May 2002 at the NATO-Russia summit, and he said these specific words: Ukraine is a sovereign, independent nation state, will make its own decisions about peace and security. Now he says it's not a nation state, and he's going to absorb it into some greater Russia. So, you know, saying that we provoked Russia is like saying that if you buy a burglar alarm, in some way you provoke burglars. Come on, this is a complete nonsense. And all he's doing here is producing new excuses for the brutal, unprovoked attack on Ukraine.
What do you make of it, though, in the context of the wider debate in Europe, particularly at a time when some governments are privately encouraging the Ukrainians to look at negotiated settlement on the question of Ukraine's future and the future of those states to the east, which the Russians have occupied and claim to have annexed, and the prospect of some governments of the right taking that view?
Well, so many on the far right are actually quite keen to apologise for what Putin is doing. You know, that's one of the characteristics of the far right, and that's precisely why Nigel Farage is engaged in this distortion of things that I've said and others have said as well. It's nothing to do with the expansion of the European Union or NATO. The brutal, unprovoked aggression against Ukraine was a decision taken by Vladimir Putin, and it was wrong. It doesn't matter what was happening next door, and nothing to do with the right of the Ukrainian people to make their own decisions about their own future.
Lord Robertson, George Robertson, former Labour Cabinet Minister and Secretary General of NATO, thank you very much. Has the quality of police chief constables declined? The sacking of Nick Adderley, the chief constable of Northamptonshire, with immediate effect for gross misconduct today, means yet another recruitment process for a chief. What's surprising is how few senior police officers apply. There are 43 police forces in England and Wales. Analysis published in December by Policing Insight, an independent organisation which monitors governance, found there had been 30 new appointments at chief constable level in just 4 years, including the replacement of the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Cressida Dick, who was forced out of her job by the Mayor of London. On average, though, only two or three people applied for each vacancy, and four of the vacancies attracted just a single applicant. Zoe Billingham was Her Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary, one of the inspectors, for 12 years, from 2009 to 2021.
There always has been a relatively high proportion of churn and turnover, and it's partly because of the very antiquated way in which someone eventually arrives at Chief Constable. You have to work your way through literally 2 years on the streets, on the front line, in neighbourhood policing and response policing, and work your way up. And quite often it takes 20 to 25 years for people to get into the chief officer rank. And at that point, the pensions incentivise people to actually leave after 30 years. So as soon as you make it to chief officer, you're almost thinking, well, I've probably got another 4 or 5 years before I'm going to take my pension and go. So I think, you know, the implications really are we need to look at the whole way that we appoint leaders into policing so that the service is fit for the 21st century.
But what many people may be surprised by is that, again, judging by that analysis, on average, in those 30 recruitments, only two or three people applied for each vacancy. In four cases, the vacancies attracted just a single applicant. Now, that, given that this is supposed to be the top job in policing that people aspire to as they rise through the ranks, it's supposed to be a really important local job in many communities, it may be surprising it just doesn't seem to attract that many people. It can't just be a question of pensions, can it?
So not enough people are coming through the service with talent into the chief officer ranks. That's changed this year. In fact, there's now 150 people making that transfer. So there's a bigger pool of candidates, basically.
So the quality could get better.
I think it will get better, but it's going to take a couple of years to come through because it is shocking, isn't it? I mean, the chief constable is a role of enormous responsibility. Literally, the safety of communities is in yours and your workforce's hands. Another factor in the reason why I think there's so few applicants to Chief Constable is because of the role of Police and Crime Commissioner. That person has the power to hire and fire Chief Constables. And you can imagine in a force, a Deputy Chief Constable may spend a couple of years as deputy, perhaps cozying up to the Police and Crime Commissioner. And when that Chief Constable role becomes vacant, many people will be put off from applying for the role because they think, well, it's a shoo-in for the incumbent deputy.
Is there also a concern? I mean, I don't know if you've heard this privately, but you obviously talk to people in policing still. I just wonder if you picked up any sense of reservation among some people who might be eligible to apply, that they're just worried that they get this job and then they're kind of at somebody else's beck and call and they're vulnerable because they can be kicked out quite easily.
Yeah, I've heard that, Sean, and it's concerning on a number of fronts, not least because it means on occasions chief constables are not willing to stand up to police and crime commissioners who decide to move into that kind of operational space, which is the domain of the police officer, the operational chief constable. But also it means that people are looking at the character of the police and crime commissioner and deciding whether or not that's someone that they could work alongside, or whether that may be someone, if, you know, if they don't act at their bidding, they may find themselves as a chief constable out of a job.
Andy Cook, who's the current chief inspector of Constabulary, so doing the job you used to do, said in December he thought the government had made a mistake when it removed the involvement of the inspectorate in the appointment process for chief constable. Do you think that as well?
I think if there's a more of an independent view coming into the whole appointment process, I think that that will help. But I do think actually moving the power away from a single individual is possibly an important thing. And more fundamentally, Sean, we have to think about how people are coming into policing leadership. This old-fashioned approach that you have to start as a PC and work your way through for 20, 25 years is really rather outdated.
Except a lot of members of the public might actually feel that one of the things they feel that the police service has lost a bit is that sense of connection with the streets, with the communities. And they might like the idea that somebody has begun their career on the beat.
I completely understand that, but there's ways and means, aren't there? I mean, the fire service, for example, in England and Wales has what's called direct entry. They bring in leaders at a senior level into the fire and rescue service who haven't spent their whole time on a watch and work their way through watch managers, station manager and all the rest of it. They're bringing in particularly diverse people, women, for example, and people from ethnic minority communities at a fairly senior leadership level to bring diversity, to bring different leadership skills, to bring different kind of thought into the fire service. And I don't think there's any reason why we can't think about policing doing a little bit more of that.
The former Inspector of Constabulary, Zoe Billingham. He may have been on the subs bench throughout France's draw tonight with the Netherlands in the Euros, but team captain Kylian Mbappe emerged for the warm-up in a mask to protect his broken nose. He hasn't required surgery, but the mask, black since the one he wore in training yesterday in the colours of the tricolour, would be a breach of UEFA's rules, which prevent players displaying national flags, will protect him during the rest of the tournament whilst the injury heals. Véronique Sauret-Johnson will have been watching hopefully tonight. French by birth, she now runs Cavendish Imaging, a British company which makes bespoke masks for injured sports players. When she came into the studio earlier with examples of her work, she told me how they've been in use by professional footballers now for more than a decade and a half.
The most well-known will be John Terry. He was actually the first player we did a mask for. He had injured both cheekbones, and the next game was tomorrow. So there was this hurry, and it's always like this with professional footballers. They're really fit. They're ready to go. They cannot stay on the bench. So being based in Harley Street in London, it's very easy for Chelsea, Fulham. I mean, I can cite most of the clubs.
They've all got your number.
Yes, exactly. So through the medical team. And the idea is to do this quickly. So we do a 3D photo to capture the surface of the face, to digitize the face, and then on computers we will design the mask to cover the area of interest. So it could be the nose, it could be the cheekbones, it could be the zygomatic, to just protect this area. We then 3D print the mask.
You've got some masks with me, so you can perhaps show me, first of all.
Yes, so this is, for example, a mask that was made to protect the nose.
Now, that feels quite rigid. I don't know if people can hear that. You probably hear the surface a little bit. It's quite a solid mask. mask. What's that made of?
So it's made of nylon. It's a very
small... Nylon?
Nylon,
blimey,
yes.
It doesn't feel like nylon.
Yes. The beauty with nylon, there's no allergy. It's, as you know, ready to wear.
I'm just putting it on, actually.
Yes, exactly.
So there's straps to go around my head just to hold it in place with Velcro or something like
exactly.
Velcro?
Exactly. So we use Velcros rather than clips, because if you get a knock on the clip, then that can be also painful.
Oh, it's quite comfortable, actually.
Yeah.
And but, I mean, obviously, it isn't designed for me, so there are gaps, and it would be bespoke.
Exactly. So that's the idea, that it just fits you like a glove.
Take that
and if you have an impact, it would spread over the facial bones that are covered by the mask, so it's like to diffuse.
So is this, in front of me, you've got a translucent mask. Is that the John Terry mask?
Yes, it is.
So this is, how old would this be now? When would this have been made?
I think it's more than 10 years ago.
Right, so this is the early stages. This is very rigid.
Yes.
This isn't nylon?
This is a nylon. This is resin.
Oh, resin, right. Yes. So if I tap it, I think people can hear, whereas if I tap one of the new ones, well, you may not hear a lot of difference, but it feels very different.
You look good.
Thank you, but it feels a bit heavier than, I mean, noticeably heavier than the later masks.
Yeah, the nylon is just so quick and... very clean.
The question, I suppose, comes from it is how comfortable are these to wear when people are running around, when they're sweating, all the rest of it?
So nylon is a very good material for that. And the fact that it's really made so specifically for you is really helpful. And when you run around, it's not moving. And when you look down, it's very thin. There's no gap, and you see your feet, you see the ball. Also, when you go to head the ball, the junction between your forehead and the mask is almost inexistent.
What other materials are used apart from nylon?
We use mostly nylon or resin. You have also carbon fibre can be a material.
What are the kind of advantages and disadvantages?
Well, carbon fibre is extremely rigid. Nylon has a little give.
Right.
That I feel it sort of goes with you.
Now, I don't know where your loyalties lie in the Euros. You don't have to tell us that if you don't want to. But you're French, but you're married to a Brit. What did you think when you heard that Mbappe had broken his nose earlier this week?
I mean, I saw the shock and the impact, and I was like, ooh, that was terrible. And I just thought, I hope he can carry on playing. I hope he's okay. The day after, my sister, who is in Paris, sent me a text message saying, please, please help him. I mean, of course, I was on the phone and trying to get to the medical team. It's very easy to come and help the player because our 3D photo equipment is portable.
Yes, you could have jumped on a plane to Germany if you'd been asked.
Exactly, exactly. And then the turnaround for the printing is very quick as well.
The lady who makes the mask, Véronique Soré-Johnson, the director of Cavendish Imaging. Now, we talked at the top of the programme about legal migration. Much of the debate in the election, though, has been about illegal migration. Here's a slightly different take on the subject. Two artists who fled Iran in fear of their lives and were smuggled into the UK in the backs of lorries have just hosted an exhibition of their work in a shipping container to try to get people to understand some of what they went through. After escaping from Iran in 2016, they spent months in what became known as the jungle, the informal camp of would-be refugees in Calais, as they made repeated unsuccessful attempts to get across the channel. The University of London supplied them with a camera to document their experience. The results have been on display this week, their first exhibition, at the Royal Foundation of St Catherine in East London. Now, you do find art in the most unusual places. That was the Docklands Light Railway rattling its way back towards central London. We're here on the edge of Limehouse, in the heart of the old East End, to meet two artists whose journey to this country is part of the exhibition they're now presenting. Two artists who had a fairly unsettling experience fleeing their homeland and finding sanctuary in the UK.
My name is Majid. I came to the UK 2016. During that 6 months, between the early November 2015, I arrived in Calais. Maybe I tried to came across the border by inside of the refrigerator or truck, lorry.
A truck with basically an ice box at the back to where they keep products and maybe meat and things like that, keep it cool while it's travelling.
Yeah, because in the refrigerator truck, they can't find the people there by the temperature of the body.
But it's a very risky way to come. come, because presumably you don't know how long you're going to wait before the driver comes to the truck and drives across to England, and you've got to worry about how you'll get out the other side.
They can't open the door from the inside, and nobody could hear your voice. Once I was around 2 days, I was inside of the refrigerator.
Did you think you were going to die in there?
Yeah, I had actually twice in this journey. I had exactly this experience and that moment. You say, oh, finish your life, and you review all of your life and say, yes, that's finished and there is not any chance.
It's an extraordinary journey you both undertook, and you both undertook it because you were forced to leave your country because of your views and the fact you dared to criticise the authorities. How much of this exhibition reflects that journey, would you say, and those experiences? And is that also why we're in this rather odd building, which is basically a shipping container that's been lined with plastic on all the surfaces? Are you trying to ensure that the people who come to the exhibition understand something of the experience you've been through?
Yeah, this journey, it was part of our life experience, and this artwork, part of that, it was difficult and different challenge. But we wanted, especially in this period of the time, because we see the news and what happened in all the Europe and sort of what the feeling of the anti-immigrant, we want the audience and people just make empathy, say, if you were to this situation, what's your decision?
Show me some pictures. You've got some under your arm there. Children's toys all piled up on the top of a suitcase.
This is in my tent. Every night I'm sleeping with toys.
And talking to them.
Yeah, sometimes it's talking because I don't have anything. These toys helped me so much.
They were your friends.
Yeah, yeah.
What is the opportunity to present your work in this exhibition in London mean to you?
First time we are human. We are Iranian, or refugee and something like that. We are human. And we are human like another people. Have an experience, have a skill, have a feeling, have a passion. But this exhibition, I have an identity. This exhibition is that you are still alive. You have an experience, you have a skill. You can do it something like that.
Those were the artists talking to me about their experience, and that exhibition unfortunately is just closed, but hopefully there'll be another opportunity to visit it in the future. That brisk gives me time to bring you the front pages of tomorrow morning's newspapers. The Daily Mail leads on Nigel Farage's claim that the West provoked Vladimir Putin to invade Ukraine. The paper says the Reform UK leader drew fury for his comments, not least, of course, on this programme earlier from George Robertson. The Guardian says Labour draws up wealth tax options to fund public services if it wins the election. And the Daily Telegraph leads with a claim from the Business Secretary, Kemi Badenoch, that Keir Starmer will reverse Brexit. Our closing headline, Foreign Secretary James Cleverly has accused Nigel Farage of echoing what he called Vladimir Putin's vile justification for the brutal invasion of Ukraine. That's the world tonight. Good night and have a good weekend.